Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast, where play meets strategy. I'm your host, Willem van der Horst. In case you're not familiar with the show, I'm a brand strategist and a tabletop gamer, and I mix those in practicing playful strategy, and I talk about all those things and a lot more with guests on the show. And on the show, for those, well, if you're familiar, you know that I've been talking for a few episodes, and more than a few episodes, about evolving the format of the show's conversations. And I'm really happy to say that this episode is a definite progress in that direction. I mean, it's happening. For this episode, I'm joined by Eric Woning, a brand and communication strategy director based in London. Eric has extensive experience with brands and digital media, creative advertising agencies like Mindshare, OMD, TBWA, and a lot more. He's worked and lived for a long time in Amsterdam and has been working in London for a number of years as well. We follow each other on Twitter. We chatted here and there about a number of common topics and asked him if he'd be up for being on the show. And I also asked him for the update and kind of evolution to the format of the show to pick a genre or a theme or something that he's really genuinely interested in. And I gave him a list of suggestions. And he shortlisted to talk about horror or post-apocalyptic topics. And the idea was for him to choose something that he's interested in. That's what I'm doing with my guests from now on. I'm still testing a little bit the range and the number of conversations, but for the guest to pick something they're genuinely and personally interested in, and I pick a game based on their interest to springboard the conversation. In this particular case, I pick the award-winning tabletop role-playing game Apocalypse World as a springboard for the conversation. Just quick note, of course, these are pretty weird times, and I'm sorry if anything to do with post-apocalyptic topics, post-apocalypse as a genre feels maybe a little bit close to reality. There's a lot of tough things that have been going on with the pandemic and with protests in the US at the moment and a lot more, and not the only one, Hong Kong and a lot of other places. So we talk about the fact that it might be a little close to reality. Just to make sure, I wanted to mention it again up front. That's not the reason why we selected this topic. Just wanted to make sure I mentioned that. And I'm aware that there's a lot of difficult things going on in reality and might feel a little bit close to home for some people. Now, we still had a really, really brilliant chat that had nothing to do with current events, going from games and role-playing games to brand archetypes to marketing strategy to working with and in agencies to digital technologies to music. Really interesting stuff on music. Eric is very much into music and a lot more than that. And I really hope you enjoy it. If you do, please share it with a friend. It makes a difference. It gets more people to find out about the show. That's the reason why I do it. And similarly, the other option is taking a moment to tell me what you thought or what you liked, because it really encourages me. And really, ideally, in the best of cases, give the show a 5-star review on your favorite podcasting app, on your phone, or on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen to it. Besides this, quick shout out for myself. I'll do some self-promotion. I've been working on a number of projects to do with delivering and designing playful strategy workshop content. And I'm speaking about that for a free webinar that I'd love for you to come to join me at. And it's going to be at the Network One's Indie Digital Forum online. I mean, it's in your living room or wherever you're going to be logged in for your computer, ideally on a laptop, because it's going to be an interactive and collaborative short bit of a workshop exercise on Tuesday, the 23rd of June, 2020, at 11 a.m. UK time, 12 p.m. Central European time. Of course, it's going to be like 6 p.m. for Hong Kong, Singapore time. So more friendly on the Asian side. And I'm sorry for our American friends, it's kind of 6 a.m. For the East Coast, so maybe not the most ideal, unless you're an early bird, in which case you're like, I would love to have you. The link is going to be in the show notes. And if you want to find out more about the workshops or any of the work that I do on Playful Strategy, or you want to chat with me and join me on the podcast, fantastic. You can find me and reach out to me on Twitter. My handle is at ICWillem, letters I and C and W-I-L-L-E-M, my first name, for Ice Cream Willem. My details are also on the website. You can find everything to do with Playful Strategy on the website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. You can also send me an email at willem@icecreamforeveryone.net. W-I-L-L-E-M. That's my first name. Just a couple brief points before we go ahead. Conversation is explicit. I think I warned about that again in the episode. There's some light swearing. Unfortunately, I also have a couple bump noises. The swearing is mostly like, just so you know, in case you have kids around. And I didn't manage to get rid of a couple of bumpy noises that I still have something going on with my desk that I need to work out in subsequent episodes. Oh, and we also have a video version of this episode. I'll post it on my YouTube channel. It's not as edited as this one, but we have all of that. Given we're recording via Zoom and we're in the days of webinars and video conversations with social distancing and the pandemic, I thought I might as well post the video at the same time so you can either listen on your normal podcasting app or you can watch and listen on YouTube. And that's about it. Without further ado, here's Eric Morning. Enjoy. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Thank you very much for making time. I really appreciate this. I'm very excited to have the conversation with you. We've been chatting on Twitter for a while, but I was just thinking, and I'm pretty sure we haven't met in person, have we?
No, we haven't.
No, I didn't think we had. And I was just checking your LinkedIn history, and I was like, yeah, you moved to London after I'd left, pretty much. Well, I did have another stint in 2016. Okay. But we seem to know people in common because we do the same job, I think, in planning. So we must, I mean, I'm guessing we know people in common in London.
Yeah, in all probability, it is a relatively small community, and especially the planners, they're an insular group. So you meet them in a couple of meetings, and it's always the same people. So yeah, it's a nice group, and I like to hang around them because, you know, by and large, they are a smart group of people. So
yeah, absolutely,
I like to hang out with people.
Should we start with a bit of an introduction? Can you tell us a little bit like who you are, where you're from, professionally and personally, a few of the highlights?
Yep. So my name is Eric Lonning, though you would not suspect it from my accent, I actually was born here in the UK. I moved away to Canada when I was relatively young, moved back here to the UK, and then moved to the Netherlands at a fairly young age and stayed there for the next over 30 years. That's hence my accent. I basically rolled into this by accident, because I wanted to do something completely different. I wanted to set up a music business, a music store, not like any other, basically based around community and making sure that you get local acts in, blah, 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 blah. But what happened at the time that I was writing basically my business plan for this was that Napster and Kazaa came up, and, you know, you didn't have to be a brilliant strategist to see that was going to have a really lasting impact. And I saw this basically a little bit before the real weight of it happened, simply because my second love had always been internet. So since 1994, I've been on the internet doing all kinds of things. And that way, I knew that this was happening and thought, well, there goes my idea. Now what do I do? So I thought, you know what, let's go and morph into that second thing that I really like to do, which was the internet. Started out on sales side and very quickly went from there on to the media side of things. And from there on out, I basically, in not too long, came to the conclusion that media and creative are things that are artificially torn apart. They belong together because content and context have to be sort of like working together. If they're not overlapping, then you've got a big problem. So that has always been my thing. And I've been working on trying to get that the right kind of work in the right kind of environment since I think something like 5 years in, and I've been doing that ever since, so for 15 years. And I've not always been that successful at it, but sometimes, you know, I've done some things that I'm proud of. So you asked me to talk about some things that I'm proud of. I worked on Airbnb on the activation side for that here in the whole of Europe. Pretty proud of that. Basically helped a very good, talented, creative come up with what later morphed into Don't Just Go There, Be There. So that was a big global campaign, which won quite a couple of awards. So that's something that I'm quite happy with, that I was able to seed the kernel of that campaign. Other things I'm happy to have done. I'm happy to have worked on O2. I've done multiple pitches that I'm won. Of course, when you win, it's always a nicer experience than when you lose. But I've done loads of things for loads of different companies, from PepsiCo all the way to Nissan, all the way
through
to
all those past few years with advertising, marketing, creative, digital agencies, that whole world, right?
Yeah. So it's like I said, I've been on multiple sides of the agency world. I've been on media agency side. I've been on creative agency side. I've been at a digital / activation agency, at a social agency. I try to do like different things, whatever I find interesting, I try to go into, but my heart is still kind of sold on the digital side of things. So I really like that, simply because it gives you more freedom of doing different things, with print, be it, you know, paper or outdoor. It's always a very standard format that you have to have. If you're doing anything like TV, then you always have your 30 seconds. Of course, in the past you could do 90 seconds, but still you're kind of, the format that you're doing is still, we open on a tell story joke somewhere in there, and then end with a big headline. With digital, you can literally go to any kind of thing that you want, which is the thing that interests me.
Thank you very much. Fantastic. All right. So for the format of the conversation, and something that's a little bit different from what I've done before, for the people listening, for the people watching us later, but everybody knows, or if you've been following this, you know, I guess, that my thing is called Playful Strategy. And it took me 5 years, but I have a tagline for the podcast called Play. It's where play meets strategy. And the idea for the thread of the conversation is that I asked you to pick a theme or topic that you were interested in. And I picked a game for us to talk about throughout the conversation. So when I asked you, you picked, and I gave you like a whole list of genres, and you picked, and you said you wanted something that would be either apocalyptic or horror-like. And I'm going to add a bumper, but I'm also going to add right now, there's for certain this conversation is going to be explicit. There's probably going to be swear words. So if ever you have kids around, you might want to not have them listen at the same time as you're listening to this, just for the sake of the warning. And I wanted to ask a little bit more about why pick that and what interests you. Is it a genre that you like? What do you like about that?
First of all, I don't want to get too much into the let's look around this kind of thing. Because it does feel slightly more topical right now.
Yes, there is that particular side. So a lot of the conversation is going to be, so the game I chose in response to it, it's called Apocalypse World. We want to be mindful. It's got nothing to do with the current situation, and we're going to be talking about this in a fictional world. And even though there has been a massive, horrible pandemic and a lot of people really suffering from it,
Yeah.
I also, and this might be a bad joke, I also think catastrophe movies still have a future, and there's going to be a lot of that in terms of literature and everywhere else. So, yeah, I don't know if that's what you were meaning to be mindful of.
And for me, it's more, I think that the thing that I like about it is the way humans react. I think that that is the thing that strategists always are after, yeah. is about how do people react to certain impulses. And the thing that I really like about the post-apocalyptic worlds and often like the modern horror kind of worlds is that the context completely changes, and therefore the way that humanity responds to that context also completely changes. So that is the thing that I really always like about this kind of thing. And if I'm completely honest, you also said, you know, pick one of these RPG genres. And one of my, I won't say favorite genres, but one of the genres that I always enjoy watching are post-apocalyptic ones. I mean, you know, the Mad Max series is something that I grew up on, and games like Borderlands and that kind of stuff. So I always have that kind of thing where I think, yeah, that's kind of cool, because not having an abundance of anything, which is, you know, what the world that we live in really does have an abundance of nearly everything. Now, take away all of that abundance, what happens then? That's, for me, a very interesting premise.
Yeah, I agree. That is a very, very interesting premise. You were forcing, going into the, you know, it's making me think of those design principles of designing for extreme cases. So mm-hmm. if you go to an extreme case, you're forcing some choice, and usually another cliche is that both the worst and the best come out of people at those kinds of times as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I'm very intrigued in that.
Perfect. And Sena, I picked a tabletop role-playing game, and you don't really know about tabletop role-playing games, right? A little bit here and there, or...
I know of it.
And there's no need to know, right? But I certainly don't want to put you in the spot or anything. And
No. So you know, if you got into the internet in 94, then that pretty much makes you a nerd. So yes, I am a bit of a nerd. Had heard of it.
That's fine. But geeks are cool now, so it's okay.
Yeah, I had heard of it. And of course, I had even, you know, funny story here. I used to own a Commodore 64, played a lot of games. There was one game that I quite liked, which was Pool of Radiance. It was a Dungeons and Dragons scroller with top-down, and basically also some things that you had first-person view. And the fun thing was, my dad is completely not a gamer at all, but that is the thing that got him into gaming. So when I one day told him about, oh yeah, this of RPGs and whatever, so my dad was like, oh, so they've translated computer games into something like a board. And I was like, no, it actually kind of started with this whole role-playing, like you don't have a board, you have to do everything in your imagination. And my dad's, he just wouldn't like, what? So I knew of it. I also quite like the format. So I'm such a nerd that I also listen to a podcast by Critical Role, quite famous in the geek world, where a bunch of voice actors do a long, long, long campaign. So I occasionally listen to it and I really enjoy it. So.
Well, yeah, they're pretty big, and they've raised millions of dollars for their animated series, and it's become it's become a big trend now of people playing role playing games, recording themselves, and for people to watch or listen. And I wasn't so much into it. I started getting slightly into it or listening from time to time, mm-hmm. but only if I'm interested in the game itself and I want to see mm-hmm. how it plays out. because my thinking up to recently actually was that I find it a lot more interesting to play the game myself than to listen to other people play it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you there. So for me, the other interesting thing is, like you said, it's gone into mainstream. And the way that you can really see that it's gone into mainstream was the other day, I believe that was on Variety. There was an article about how one of the biggest high-rolling games in Vegas right now has nothing to do with poker, but it's actually a D&D campaign in which Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine, the guitarist, he plays D&D, so the two guys behind a Game of Thrones are in that campaign. Vince Vaughn, the actor, is in that campaign. So it's like really huge.
I did not
huge
know
names.
That.
No,
that's
no.
Really,
no.
I need to check out that article. That's great.
Yeah.
It just reassures me that I might be in the right area, focusing on that. Maybe at some point, I don't know. But I certainly enjoy it. So I picked this game called Apocalypse World for us to chat through. Mm-hmm. And my idea was that we can talk about making a character, but we can go into tangents about whatever comes up, and we can talk about brand personalities and characters and creative, whatever we come up with, because I think there's a lot of richness to it. But let me describe a little bit the game. The game came out in 2010, and for everybody, and for those, I don't know, I'll see. But anyway, so you're just talking about Dungeons & Dragons. And Apocalypse World, when it came out, made quite a bit of noise in the geek gaming world and won a bunch of awards because it has a particular philosophy about the way that they're looking at the characters and the way that the game is played. So role-playing games, you incarnate a character, and you have one of the people in the group who is like the dungeon master, the game master. In Apocalypse World, that person is called the Master of Ceremonies. And traditionally, Dungeons & Dragons particularly focuses on, the name indicates, the dungeon. And so the person who's the game master may well have designed or bought or read in a book a whole thing with rooms and dungeons and monsters. And you have to go with your group of people incarnating characters from one room to the next, battle monsters, deal with traps or other things like that, and get rewards, treasure and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And so the game master has all of this stuff prepared in advance, and the players react to it. There's a whole other school of thought about improvising the story with the players. So there's a lot less prepared in advance by the person leading the game.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of like theory going on about how this whole thing works. And D. Vincent Baker, the creative of Apocalypse World, and his wife as well, the two of them created it together, have a few different ways of looking at things. It's just a slightly different way to play. But I think that what I would say is the driving kind of gaming design philosophy is to play to find out. So in a game of Dungeons & Dragons where the person knows, they know where all the dragons are, they know where all the monsters are, they know, and they're waiting for the players to come through. In this situation, what the game is designed around the relationships between the characters and creating trouble inside of the relationship between the characters and the relationship between other types of characters. And the idea is you create setups for probably a lot of things to go wrong, because that's where it's interesting and apocalyptic, just like we were. And you force situations to go into having to make wrong or bad or like bad or worse decisions. And then you play to find out what happens, and you don't know in advance what happens.
Sounds really interesting.
Yeah, and with the environment of Apocalypse World being that about 50 years ago something happened that the whole world went completely wrong, and the environment is, you know, drug lords, ash from the sky. There's this weird psychic maelstrom, they call it, that you can tune in your brain to. Something went horribly, horribly wrong. And it's just extremely bleak. It's grim. It's people are doing the worst they can to, or the best or the worst they can to survive. And life is cheap and et cetera. So that's like, the situation is dire. There's like cars exploded, buildings half destroyed. People live either on the road or inside of just makeshift holdings where they're trying to live as best they can. There's like makeshift kind of barter money.
Yeah.
And when you play typically with a group of people. And this mm-hmm. game gave rise to a style of gaming of role-playing games called Powered by the Apocalypse. So, the rules system that I'm talking that I was yeah. talking about, the designed and where you play to find out. They created a bunch of other games with the same idea.
Okay.
So you incarnate a character, right? Mm-hmm. And you can choose among 11 different ones. And I sent this a whole document to you with like very little context, none of the keys to explain how that worked. Yeah. And probably normally, I don't know, what was your reaction looking at that kind of list of characters?
I was literally thinking, how does this play out? You know, I have no idea how this would work, first of all, but I also have no idea. Traditionally, you know, if you look at games, the video game industry has really taken cues from basically the tabletop role-playing industry, in which they've looked at things like inventory, health, strength, all of that kind of thing. So I was looking for that. I was like, there's none of that here. How the hell am I supposed to know what kind of thing this character is? So it was quite difficult for me to see through that. So I had to go with my gut instinct, like, okay, what is the kind of character that you would normally never choose, but which always intrigues you? Mm-hmm. So in that way, I went with a kind of scary guy called the Brainer.
Yeah,
that was the one that spoke to me most, because he's like a psychic. Again, you know, I'm a child of my age, so I love all of this psychic horror kind of trope. There was a lot of that going around in the 80s and 90s. I mean, X-Files, for God's sakes. So that kind of thing. Yeah, I thought, why not give that a try?
Perfect. Great. So we'll come back to that. I was also thinking of something else when talking about characters, and just to give a little bit more background, this is more for you, but also for people who don't necessarily know that much about role-playing games, making a parallel with the work as well of, brand strategy, mm-hmm. and something I've been thinking about. So traditionally, and actually if you've played video games, and you have as well, you'd be familiar with that kind of idea. But when we're talking about a character and incarnating a character, putting ourselves in the shoes of some other fictional character, there's a model that expresses who that character is. And usually with traits or stats or so something that expresses what they're about, or if they're strong, or if they're agile, or if they're smart, or if they're et cetera, right? And I know that, so it might be looking like a little bit Jungian archetypes. That's one way to look at that. And I know there's multiple people have done work on looking at what are the traits or characters or types of brands. I don't know if you've done any work on that kind of thing, or much thinking around that, or if you've used those types of, or anything like that. Because I'm starting to look at it myself, and I'm trying to pull from an analogy perspective, what can I learn from the role-playing game world where we have a model that is representing a character through different traits, mm-hmm. and transpose that to, all right, what would be traits that are interesting to look at for a brand, and is there a way to use that to do that in a uniform fashion?
So, I have been doing that kind of work, especially at my stint at TVWA. I led quite a couple of what is called disruption sessions. And these disruption sessions normally were all about it's basic strategy, right? Where is your brand right now? And where do you want to be? What is basically the problem that is defined at this moment? Where do you want to be? How do we get there? And they have this thing where they say it's the convention. Basically, what is everyone in your kind of field? What are they doing? And where do you want to be? How do you want to change that? And that how do you want to be basically is very much also inward looking. and looking at the brand and looking at the company and what kind of company are you, what makes you stand out, and basically trying to find the differentiating thing or the thing that we can grasp on that others aren't doing right now. So I've done that. But for me, I always find that slightly less interesting than the trying to get into creative work. And the reason that I find all of this conversation interesting is, for me, I think that context is really underestimated. And for that, I would like to go back to something that seems quite tangential, but David Byrne, in his book, How Music Works, he literally explains that it wasn't that music changed and therefore the venues changed. It was that the venues changed where this music was being played and therefore the music changed. And that is a much larger factor into what actually happens than the other way around. Which is why
what time period is he talking about when he's talking about the venues?
He's talking about the
all of it.
Forever. Oh. So it starts off with Gregorian chants in big churches. You had to have those long notes because basically these concrete walls vibrate the sound back. So you can't do this kind of noodling, which afterwards people like Mozart were very able to do because they went into smaller rooms where they played on instruments that had this kind of way of reacting to this smaller room, which was padded. And you can see it in things like traditionally you would have an orchestra and they would be playing in a hall, but they would be playing in a hall where people were actually also eating and talking and all of that kind of thing. So what had to happen was, because these halls got bigger and people got more in there, it was rowdier. So they had to have bigger orchestras. So that's how the bigger orchestra came into being. And he explains it all the way through to punk rock being at CBGB's and why that room was so well equipped for something such as punk rock or actually even country music. So he shows all the way through time how that has changed. And that for me is a very nice analogy of looking at our the way that we look at what we make. We have to make something that actually fits within the idea that we have, has to fit within the space that we put it in, because otherwise you're making it in a way that doesn't really work well, and it will never really give you the same kind of resounding success that something else could give you. So that's where I think that this, something like this, is very interesting.
That is very interesting. That's awesome. So to sum it up, like, to what you're saying, it's like, don't worry too much about the shape of your instrument or who is in the band, but worry about where you're performing and what it's looking like from the acoustic perspective.
Yes. So I was talking to someone the other day who was saying, you know, often you can look at another campaign and use that as a jumping point to look at the idea. And if you... basically, what you can do is you can jump all over the walls, because then you can say, okay, if this is the idea, how would we execute it differently? Okay, what could the idea for that then be? And then you can go slightly in a different direction. And that way you can get to a place very easily. Like, okay, what if we would do this kind of idea in this kind of setting? And you get a completely different kind of execution that feels 100% differently than the thing that it actually originated from. So I think that there's quite a lot of nice stuff that we can do with that.
Yeah. Do you think you need to necessarily take a little bit more risk in not exactly knowing what's going to come out of it when you take risks into, like, oh, let's try something to a new kind of shape?
As a strategist, yes. Yes, because the thing that we often don't get right is it's not our job to come up with the solution. We always try to get to the solution. Our job is to come up with the most interesting and most workable problem. And if we get to that point, then we can quite easily give it over to the creative. And that would be, in this case, the master of ceremony or the GM, who then comes up with, okay, that gives me the space to do this kind of thing with it.
Yeah. And I tend to agree, but it's what's also difficult and funny is that where the expectation in the agency setting that we were just talking about is that by the end of it, we're going to have a something that is completely wrapped up in a very good, well solution, well done, with a bow on it and nice slides so that you can just present it to the client and they could say yay or nay. Ideally, yeah. You would include the person who's going to be buying this stuff as well, although that's, I don't know what you think on that, but.
Well, I think that's quite interesting. So it depends on the kind of person that you have. I do believe that it's much better to take clients along the road of, we've looked at what you say that your problem is, and we believe that the underlying problem is this. And therefore, we're coming to these kinds of ideas and take them along the road and have them have some say in it as well. Because the idea of treating clients as babies who can't really think until they've seen the end product, apart from it being patronizing, I think that it also doesn't work. In the sense that if they don't have buy-in of the idea, it's a lot easier for them to not agree with it. You can also look at it like when you're shooting to something, you can try to aim as good as possible, but you can also try to go from the other side, from this side, and go backwards. And that is a lot more effective because then it's slightly less aiming in the wrong way. So as long as you take this other person along with you, they will have that buy-in and they will be able to course correct. Like, no, we would never be able to do this as a company. We would never be able to come at it from that kind of angle because of X, Y, and Z. And they can give you information that you don't have because having those different perspectives is really good. So working at it from both directions, I think, is the thing that we should be trying to do.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree.
But I do understand that some clients get really hung up on details. You know, for them, they are not advertising specialists. This is something that we also should understand. They are marketing specialists. We only do 1P. They should be doing 4Ps. So product and price and place as much. So yeah, for them, they should trust us because we are the advertising specialist. But that also means that we really have to take them along and that we have to help them to understand, to think in our kind of way. And that's sometimes difficult because, you know, they still are clients and they have to understand that kind of way of thinking. So sometimes you will have to do it in a smart way. But I do believe that this is the way that we should look at things.
Thank you. Cool. All right. Let me tell you a few more things about Apocalypse World and the game. Right, so yeah. The way that it functions as the main system operates by moves and there's mm-hmm. dice involved. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple system where when you have your character, mm-hmm. you want to act, you make a move. And making a move, there's a bunch of different descriptions and you describe, and it's role-playing games are a conversation just like we're having. Yeah. And you describe what's going on, ideally in a group, and Apocalypse World is very much made to be played at a group of 3 to 5 people with, as I said, the Master of Ceremony and the other people. And when you're making a move, you roll 2 six-sided dice, normal, mm-hmm. I mean normal, quote-unquote normal ones.
Yeah.
These ones, basically. And if you roll less than 7, you fail. Mm-hmm. If you roll 7 to 9, it's called a weak hit. And that means mm-hmm. it's like you kind of succeed, but something goes wrong at the same time.
Yeah.
And 10 plus, you just like succeed at what you're trying to do. And the game is, statistically, the game is rigged so that most of the time you have something go wrong. Which I heard recently that is given rise to a lot of people arguing about what is the right way to do game mechanics statistically. But that's also always interesting, I find, to know that there's been a philosophy behind it. The philosophy here is that you're living in an apocalypse world and you're living through adventures where if everything went right, why would you be playing? Because ultimately, there's got to be things that go wrong. And so you incarnate these characters, and the rule is that anything to do with your character, you own entirely. Anything to do with the world and the other characters beyond you, that is owned pretty much by the Master of Ceremonies. But they may well ask a lot of questions so that you construct the world together. So, for example, you might say, okay, well, I'm going to go look for water because that's the thing over there. It's like it's not readily available. And I will say, okay, great. How do you do that? And I'll leave you the choice to say, and I might describe a little bit what's happening. Well, there's a water tower over there. There's a bunch of destroyed cars in front of it. It looks like there's seriously aggressive dogs. There's a dude sleeping in front. So I might describe a situation and then ask you, what do you want to do and how do you want to do it? But let's backtrack a little bit. That was just to give you a little bit of how it works. And you were talking about the character and the brainer. And the brain, so every character is like a stereotype. It's a stereotype of a type of person we've seen in apocalyptic type movies. So it's their mishmash of a lot of different people we might have seen on one of the Mad Max movies somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And the brainer is the strange psychic mind meld power person who can read minds. And everybody says, usually there's one around because they're useful to have. Everybody's scared of them, so you don't really want to have them around. Well, there's another peculiarity of this particular game is that, which is something that doesn't really happen in Dungeons and Dragons, there's rules for sex. There's rules for character. There's special things that happen when characters have sex with each other.
Okay.
And the way that the game is written, because it's a book, basically, right? It's extremely conversational and it's slangy. So the author uses a lot of slang and writes like they're talking to you directly. So
interesting.
It is quite interesting. So I'll pick an example quickly.
While you're looking, that reminds me a bit of one of my favorite books of all time, Clockwork Orange.
Yes.
Where the first page, you literally have no idea what's written there. And you have to like read a couple of pages to go like, oh, okay. So cold chalk means talk. Vidi means see. Okay, now let's go back a couple of pages. In what way? Now I understand. So it pulls you into that world in a lot quicker way than actually describing it is by actually talking to you in the way of the world. I quite like that idea.
Absolutely. And I've not read Clockwork Orange. I've only seen the movie, actually. That reminds me. It says, I'll read a paragraph because, I mean, I just paraphrased exactly that, but it says at the beginning of the book to an intro, it's called the conversation. You probably know this already. Role-playing is a conversation. You and the other players go back and forth talking about these fictional characters and their fictional circumstances doing whatever it is that they do. Like any conversation, you take turns, but it's not like taking turns, right? Sometimes you talk over each other, interrupt, build on each other's ideas, monopolize, all fine. All these rules do is mediate the conversation. They kick in when someone says some particular things and they impose constraints on what everyone should say after. Makes sense, right?
Well, that's really interesting. I'm going to do one thing back.
Yeah,
that's please. The way that I also really like to work with creatives. So, basically throwing out there this is the context that we're in, and very often they come back with ideas like, oh yeah, but this and that, and then you have to go back to them and say, well, but look at this constraint. This constraint is really important. Oh, well, then I have to change this idea in this way. Oh yeah, then we could, and people build on each other, and it's I believe that that's the most healthy way to get to better things, and I don't think that that is a brainstorm, which has its own benefits and let's say detractions, but I definitely love that kind of thing. That's the thing that I like most about my work, having that kind of interaction. So it's interesting that this game has that.
It is, right? And I found this very interesting to learn more about different trends and design trends in role-playing games and other types of games. And I absolutely agree with you on the way to work. And I still have a lot to learn. I always have a lot to learn and a lot to grow into for sure. But when I look, there's a parallel path, I think, in like looking at how I do, and I used to play the role-playing games when I was much younger, and being nervous about talking to a group of people and thinking I had to have the right answer. I have to have all the things to impress the players. I have to control what they're doing. And when preparing a meeting with the creative team, I used to think about the same thing. I used to think that I needed to have all the answers. I needed to have the right ideas. I needed to have the solutions, and they should be listening to what I have to say and go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
Kind of, really. But and then the more you do it, and the more I realize that exactly what you said is that I don't really have anything, but as much as possible, the best way I can do is to learn as much as I can, summarize it as best I can, and be there like to have a way forward to say, okay, I think this is the way forward. Let's talk about it. What do you think?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And it's really interesting because going back to gaming, that it's really the difference between much more of an open world where you can show them the open world versus the being on a railroad, at which if you say it like that, it actually sounds like D&D is more structured towards railroading, whereas this kind of game is far more open world and let's see where we get to together.
Yeah, it tends to be. Now, the latest edition of Dungeons & Dragons has a little bit more geared towards open world, and I have not played in a while. But it takes more effort to make Dungeons & Dragons a little bit more, arguably, and there's people who would argue this point. For me, it takes a little bit more to play Dungeons & Dragons as an open world and open conversation than this, which is expressly designed to be that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, whereas totally Dungeons & Dragons is like you're going to have the pleasure's not the same for some of those games where it's more tactical in figuring out exactly how you're going to put your resources together to be able to beat the monster, dragon, or whatever. Yeah. And it's a different kind of pleasure.
Yeah.
Different kind of structure as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you create your character and you have moves that are specific that everybody has. And then there's moves that you choose. So actually, let's go through the traits. So I was talking earlier about the fact that the characters have traits, and that is typical of a lot of pretty much every single role-playing game has some way to represent what the character is. In the same way that I wrote a blog post about making analogies between a creative briefing document. Well, I'm looking for the right page. The PDF I'm looking at is not annotated, which is super annoying because I keep going backwards and forwards. And I'll read the other blurb about brainers if you had questions. And the brainer, so and nobody can have, if you're playing in a group at Apocalypse World, everybody has to have a separate stereotype character. So there's only one brainer in the group, and that's in this case would be you, right? They're spooky, weird, weirdly fun to play. The moves are powerful but strange. And if you want everybody else to be at least a little bit afraid of you, a brainer is a good choice. Warning, you'll be happy anyway, but you'll be happiest if somebody wants to have sex with you, even though you're a brainer, because people don't really like brainers. They're weird. Angle for that if you can.
Yeah.
And then the stats. So the stats in this game are cool, meaning that you keep cool under fire. You're calm, rational, clear thinking, calculating, unfazed.
Okay.
Hard means you're hard-hearted, sorry, that's difficult to say. Strong-willed, violent, aggressive, mean, physically and emotionally strong. Hot meaning you're super hot, attractive, subtle, gracious, sexy, beautiful, inspiring. Sharp means you're sharp-witted, clever, alert, smart, perceptive, educated. Weird means you're weirder, psychic, genius, uncanny, lucky, strange, prophetic, touched. So the brainer has a strong weird.
Yep.
HX is history. That's another stat. So at the beginning of the game, you create history with all the other characters. Okay. And the way this works, you know, I said you throw two dice to act, and usually throw two dice plus one of the stats. So you do 2d6 plus the stats, and the stats go from -3 to +3. And when you create your character, you just choose. There's four different sets, and you choose where you're going to have like ones that have pluses, ones that have minus, but ones that are dominating on your side. So the brainer is always dominating and weird because that's his thing, right?
Yeah.
And then there are specific moves that you can choose, and that I have here.
Yeah.
And you choose two. And so to give an idea of how that works, and you've read the document, but is you choose two of the special moves that a brainer has. And one is when you try to seduce someone, you roll with weird instead of rolling with hot, which is how you roll normally. And there's one that you can get plus one weird. There's one, it's called casual brain receptivity. So it's like, there's a move that that allows you to read people. It's a like kind of cold read, you know?
Yeah.
But instead, this is like you can almost read what's going on in their minds and what how emotionally how they're feeling.
Okay.
There's another one that almost allows you to do telepathy. And there's another one which allows you to plant commands into people's minds.
Ooh. I hadn't read that. That's really interesting. Yeah. So would I have to choose two now?
Yeah, well, you don't have to. You can, if you have ideas or if it makes you think of anything in particular, if you're creating a character, you'd have to choose two between.
Yeah.
But we don't really have to, you know, do that specifically at this particular point. But it's just to give you an idea of what goes on with a character. And I know that that's something that I'll do at some point maybe is to do a short scene to test the game out or to see actually if you're interested. So given everything you've heard so far, you're interested in playing this game?
Yeah, no, I would be very interested in playing this game.
I didn't even know that you listen to actual role-playing game playthroughs, because that's another thing I've been wondering about trying to put together. But it's between me and other people, putting the schedules of a lot of busy people together is challenging.
No, I think that if you want to do that in a good way, you have to be very, set at it. You have to have a set time and everyone has to make time for it because otherwise it won't work. I used to play in a band. And it's exactly like playing in a band. So if not everyone is there, it basically means that you can't really go through with it. So everyone has to be there. And you really have to have the discipline to say no to everything else. And the later you come into life, the more difficult it is to actually always be able to do that. So
absolutely. What instrument did you play in the band?
I was the bassist.
Cool. So yeah, you're going to ask a question?
Sorry? No, I was going to say, which basically also is the strategist instrument, right?
Is it? Because it plays in the background and it's like you can't really hear it, but it makes everything, or no?
Exactly. It's literally that. It's like the singer and the guitarist are the things that everyone focus on. So I would say that would be the person who would be creative and maybe the account person. And then someone like the project manager would be the drummer, because he kind of like makes all of the space for it. But then there's something that has to go in between that makes sure that everything kind of makes sense and everything gels together and actively works, which is the bassist. So.
Wow. Cool.
That's my quick look at it. Anyway, so that's also the reason why I've never really gone into it, because the moment that I actually got really interested in this kind of thing was so late in my life that I've never really had the time to say, okay, set date, that's when we do it. I also never really had the friend group, to be honest, because my friend group has always been basically music related.
Got it. And but you also said that you, so on other types of games, and one I was interested in chatting with you about is figurine and your figurine painting.
Yeah.
That's something that you do?
Yes, that is.
So what type of figurine games? Is it board games or like, is it kind of war games or?
Yeah, it's board games, but it's especially dungeon crawlers because what happened, I don't know, it's a year and a bit ago, I suddenly realized that all of the things, everything that I like to do was screen-based. So because I don't play in a band anymore, yes, I do have, if you can see it over there in the background, you will see a bass at the bass guitar. So yes, I do still have a bass, but most of the music that I make is actually on the computer. And I do quite a bit of DJing because I like it on the computer. So all of the, let's say, administrative work around it is on the computer. So it got to a point where everything that I like to do outside of my work was still on a computer. And I just thought, this isn't good. So I thought, what can I do? Well, I was on my computer. And YouTube suggested this thing where it was about figurine painting. So looked into it and thought, well, why not give it a go? I have this game called Descent, which I bought aeons ago.
It's a huge box of stuff. I've not played it, but I know that there's a lot in there.
Yeah, and it's all about the tactical stuff. And I showed it to my son, and it was more that I thought, you know what, let's set it up, let's see how it actually plays. And my son Luke saw it and he absolutely loved it. So I thought, you know what, why not paint these guys and make it into something that we do together? And it's kind of really weird because he shouldn't be able to do it. He's 4, nearly 5 years old. And he got it into it and he really understands it. And it's really funny because the dice that you use are six-sided dice, like you just showed, but it has 3 different stats on each side of the dice. And you have to understand that. And you roll multiple dice to attack and for range and all of that kind of thing. But he got it quite quickly. And we've been basically adding a little bit of layers on top of that, like line of sight and all of that kind of stuff. And he actually loved it. So with that, I thought, okay, yeah, I'm going to start painting. And it's kind of difficult and it's kind of a rabbit hole to go down, because as soon as you really get into it, you get into the, yeah, but this still doesn't really look good enough. How could I make it look better? And then you look at these YouTube tutorials and you go like, oh, wow, these guys are good. And you start to get better and better at it. Or in my case, suck slightly less at it.
Oh, but it's great. You're moving ahead and doing it. I know I have a good friend who has a YouTube channel for figurines and figurine painting. He's not in this. So he does some figurine painting in the channel. The channel is about figurine gaming, wargaming. Okay. But he usually says he doesn't like painting. So his whole philosophy of painting figurines is just to be as effective as possible. So when he does videos about painting, he's like, all right, here's how you can do it in minimum time, maximum effect.
Okay. That's really funny. No, I started doing it and I really like it. The only problem that I have is that, I don't have the time for the amount of figurines that I have. And for instance, right now, he doesn't know, his birthday is in about a month. And I'm every evening, I'm painting like crazy to get all these things done in time. It's a fun thing as long as you don't make it into a work thing.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to look at it. Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, this is really cool. It's been a lot of fun. So we're going to just start closing up slowly. And usually I finish up with these cool down questions. Yeah. It's still the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. So do you have a favorite ice cream flavor I usually ask? If you like ice cream, yeah. If you eat ice cream.
Yeah, no, I love ice cream. but I'm a bit... So this is going to sound really bad, but the thing that I really like is vanilla. Yeah. I think that people don't really taste vanilla. They think, okay, let's get through the vanilla as quickly as possible. But vanilla as a taste is really delicious, and I really like it. So I'm going with something really, the thing that I normally try to not be, vanilla.
No, exactly. But it's funny because I'm kind of the same. But I don't like the fact that it's associated with being bland. vanilla is associated with being the norm, with being bland, and I'm like, I don't like that. It's because that's good. If you look good, if you look good.
Yeah.
And funny enough, you were telling me your story about, so I obviously have a very Dutch name, but I didn't grow up in Holland or anything. My father's Dutch.
Yeah.
But I did go there on vacation growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And vanilla ice cream specifically in the Netherlands when I used to go on vacation is something that I do remember because it didn't taste the same as in France.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. I don't remember having it in France. So hopefully soon I can try that out.
Yes, hopefully. We just had news. I mean, I'm not sure. I'll be publishing this probably in a few days, but that I think from next Monday, the lockdown is easing even more and they're going to be reopening restaurants and everything else. I need to double check exactly what the news content is.
Well,
another thing I ask is usually, what's a piece of media that you really, really enjoyed yesterday, like recently, something that had an impact on you? So that means it could be a TV show, a movie, a music, an artist, anything.
Okay, so I've been doing a lot of painting, and I'm not going to say it makes me happy or I enjoy it, but what I find really good is I don't use my computer. I use it more as a podcasty kind of thing. So I have it somewhere and I listen to it. I've been listening a lot to Ian Curtis's work. He's a documentary maker who basically documents the where power lies in society and why it lies there. So a lot of it is about how individualism has morphed our society into a different kind of place, how politics used to be about trying to sell you something of what we would aspire to, whereas now it's kind of flipped on its head and it's become something where they are trying to prevent the bad things from happening because that's the only role that they really see in an individualistic world. And there's a lot of things about how the way works, which I've been really, really listening to quite a lot. And I found it very, very interesting.
Awesome.
I would highly recommend it.
I don't know that. Cool. Fantastic. Yeah.
Century of the Self. Century of
century
the Self.
Century of the Look. Self? Soul yes. or self?
Self. So self. The Century okay. of the Self.
Great. I'll check it out and I'll add it to the show notes. Fantastic. And the last question, if there was one thing, value, it could be physical or not physical, that you, if you wished it and you everybody had it, what might that be?
This is going to sound so cliche.
The question leads to that kind of thing, I think, a little bit. I'm testing out regularly testing out questions, but
empathy.
Empathy.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think that if we would be slightly more empathetic towards each other and actually listen instead of the kind of listening where you're just waiting until the other person has shut up so you can say the thing that you want to say, that would help us all quite greatly.
Fantastic. That's a great note to end on. And where can people find you? You're on Twitter, or is there anything else anywhere that people can find you?
Yeah, they can all find me on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Basically right now I'm a strategist without a role. So if there's anyone listening to this who is looking for a type of strategist who combines brand strategy with comm strategy, please hit me up. You can find me on LinkedIn, Eric Voning. You can find me on Twitter under Koning Voning, which is my nickname and has been my nickname for, I don't know, 3 decades by now. So it's a bit of a weird Dutch thing.
Fantastic.
But that's KoningWoning.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. Another episode gone by. Thank you so much for listening to it. You can find out all the back catalog of the episodes. I think we're at 79 episodes so far. You can find that on your podcast app, on the website at icecreamforeveryone.net. The vast majority of all the conversations with the guests are pretty timeless stories. Like, it's really finding out about people's pasts with a range of fascinating design and strategy professionals. So I recommend checking out the past episodes. They still work out really well. And I'll be back with another episode very soon. As I mentioned at the beginning, if you enjoyed the episode, please give it a bit of a boost by sharing it with a friend, posting it on Twitter, giving it a 5-star rating and a review, ideally. That'd be fantastic. It helps other people find out about the show because, and really the other reason is it encourages me to record more episodes that I know that you enjoyed it, or give me feedback if there's anything you enjoyed or didn't enjoy. I most appreciate honest feedback too, so please reach out, no problem. And I have time for new work, as Eric, similarly to what Eric mentioned, time for new work, clients, workshops, if it can help you with anything on the brand strategy side of things, introduce you to my ideas of playful strategy, please reach out. You have all my details on the website, which is at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. You can reach me by email. That's at Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out. That's about it for now. Thank you very much. Good morning, afternoon, evening, night, whatever time it is for you when you listen. Talk to you soon.